Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, in our discussion of the Majjhima Nikaya, the suttas of the Majjhima Nikaya, we've been discussing suttas which I have put under the category of suttas that deepen our perspective on the world. And within this category, we explain the great discourse on the mass of suffering, which exposes the suffering or unsatisfactoriness and sensual pleasures in bodily form and in feelings. Then we examine the Potaliya Sutta, which again explores in more detail the unsatisfactoriness and sensual pleasures. Then the Magandhya Sutta, which again expounds the unsatisfactoriness in sensual pleasures and in bodily existence. And then we took a sutta from, or a series of suttas from the Samyutta Nikaya, which expound the misery, the wretchedness of samsara, the cycle of birth and death. Okay, and now we will see many of these themes come together in the dramatic story of the life of one of the leading disciples of the Buddha. This is the story of Ratthapala, which is narrated in Sutta number 82 of the Majjhima Nikaya, the Ratthapala Sutta. And it is said that the Buddha had 80 disciples who were distinguished for certain outstanding characteristics. These 80 disciples come from the bhikkhus or monks, the bhikkhunis or nuns, the lay followers, the male lay followers, upasikas, and the women lay followers, upasikas. And amongst the bhikkhus, there was one monk singled out as the foremost of those who go forth into homelessness out of faith. And that honor belongs to the Venerable Ratthapala. And this sutta narrates his personal story and helps to explain why he was appointed to this category. Okay, the sutta opens when the Buddha has been traveling in the Kuru country with a large community of monks, and he arrives at a town in the Kuru country called Tulakotita. Now the Kuru country is located in the western part of the area in which the Buddha lived and taught. It's said to correspond with present-day Uttar Pradesh. And the capital of Uttar Pradesh is Delhi. So this would be far to the west of the area where the Buddha usually taught. But even though this region was away from the epicenter of the Buddha's teaching activities, in this Kuru country, the Buddha has taught some of his most important discourses. It was here that he taught the famous Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse on the foundations of mindfulness. Here that he taught the Mahanidana Sutta, the great discourse on causation. That's the largest discourse on dependent origination. Also it was here that he taught the Magandhya Sutta, which we examined a few weeks ago. Okay, so when the Buddha arrives in the town of Tulakotita, then the report about his arrival spreads amongst the community. And so then many of the, this was a Brahmin town, and so the Brahmin householders of this town all congregate to see the Buddha, some of them who have some seed of faith pay homage to the Buddha, others greet him courteously, others just announce their name and clan to him, while others, these I imagine to be the cynics or skeptics in the group, sit down, sit down silently and wait for him to speak. These are probably the ones who are thinking, oh, these bald-headed ascetics are all the same. They can't work at a decent job and earn their own income. They have to go around wandering from town to town, milking the poor, simple people with their myths and fables about merit and heavenly rebirth. Let's see what this fellow has to say. Okay. I'm skipping. I'm not explaining in detail the preliminary passage since we've already encountered the same stock passage in earlier suttas. Okay, so now in this group of householders who are listening to the Buddha preach, expound the doctrine, there was one young man by the name of Ratapala. And according to our text, he was the son of the leading clan in that town. So within these towns, there would be different families arranged in some kind of hierarchical order. And generally, there would be a leading family which would be exercise the governing role in that community. It would make issue directives for the rest of the community, the townspeople to follow. And so a great deal of prestige and honor attached to that clan. And as we will see from as the text proceeds, Ratapala was in fact the only son within that clan. And so he would have played a very important, or would have had very important future prospects lined up for him in continuing the family lineage. And while Ratapala was sitting there listening to the Buddha preach the Dhamma, a thought occurred to him. In fact, the words that are put into his mouth or into his mind are actually, it's actually a stock phrase which the Buddha himself uses when he explains the sequence of events that induce a person to go forth into the homeless life. And in fact, these were the thoughts that occurred to the Buddha himself when he was living in the palace before he took that dramatic step of leaving the worldly life and entering the life of renunciation. So here Ratapala thinks, as I understand the Dhamma or doctrine taught by the Blessed One, it is not easy while living in a home to lead the holy life, utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. This is the conch shell, which is smooth, flawless, bright white. So it's considered a kind of auspicious object, the symbol of radiant perfection and purity. And so the desire arises in him. Let me shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. Now, this is really a very key phrase for understanding the Buddha's original teaching, that it is not easy while living at home to lead the utterly perfect and pure holy life. And why should this be the case? Because to lead the utterly pure and perfect holy life in its entirety, one has to fulfill to perfection, we call the three categories of training. The training in virtue or morality, but it's actually more than morality, but it's a kind of higher ethics, which includes not only purely moral principles, but also principles of, call it self-discipline, the striving for self-mastery in one's conduct. So the perfection of sila, virtue, and morality would include the observance of celibacy, restraining from all expressions of sexual desire. It would include restraint over the senses, restraining the senses from indulging in the enjoyments of sense objects. It would include the development of such qualities as fewness of wishes, not having desire for many things, being content with little, being fond of solitude. And it would include the observance of many other principles of conduct which are not absolutely moral in their import, in the sense of relating to the relations between human beings, but rather are concerned with the achievement of self-mastery, or mastery over the mind, with its desires, impulses, inclinations, propensities. Then the fulfillment of the holy life would involve the mastery of samadhi, concentration. This would be the attainment of the deep meditative absorption, the ability to withdraw the mind from its involvement in sensory data, to withdraw the mind from its immersion in the stream of thought, feelings, desires, and enter into these very deep, blissful, and peaceful states of tranquil absorption. And then the fulfillment of the holy life would require the perfection of wisdom, of insight into all of the principles of the Dhamma, the things that are to be investigated and realized with wisdom. And this wisdom, in its higher sense, has to be built upon a foundation of virtuous conduct and concentration. But when it's said that the fulfillment or perfection of the holy life is difficult to accomplish while living in the home at home, this does not mean that the practice of the higher Dhamma is restricted to monastics. In fact, in the early suttas, the early discourses of the Buddha, we see many lay people very diligently take up the practice within the circumstances of household life, and they achieve, in terms of the four stages of liberation, four stages of awakening, many of them are successful in achieving the first three stages of liberation, that is, the stage of stream entry, once returning, and non-returning. And there are cases reported of some lay people who are still living the household life who attain the fourth and final stage, the stage of arhatship. But there's no case reported of one who achieves arhatship as a layman who does not either attain it just before death, right on the verge of death, or else who, after achieving it, does not immediately or very soon after achieving it go forth into the monastic life. So because of this, the idea came to become prominent, at least in the Theravada tradition, that if a householder achieves arhatship as a householder, there are two possibilities. Either he will pass away or take ordination. I think it's either within 24 hours or within 7 days. I'm not sure of the exact figure. Okay, so this thought occurs to this young man, Ratapala. And now after the Buddha's discourse, then all of the Brahmin householders get up from their seats. Some of them express their appreciation to the Buddha. Then they depart, they head for their homes. And according to the commentary, Ratapala intended to go and speak to the Buddha, but he didn't want to be conspicuous by staying behind. And so he set out to return with his fellow townsmen. But after he went a little way, then he used some pretext. He said that he had to relieve himself and go off into the bushes and told them to go on home, I'll catch up later. And so while they returned home, then he backtracked and went back to the Buddha. And then he told the Buddha what he was thinking, and he asked him right on the spot, please, venerable sir, give me the going forth and give me the full admission or the higher ordination. This distinction here refers to two stages in monastic ordination. What's rendered as going forth is pabbaja. Yeah, pabbaja is the initial ordination, the first ordination, which confers on the candidate the status of samanera, or we say a novice monk. And this can be given to anyone, generally above the age, virtually of 7 or 8. It's very seldom that it's given to a boy so young. But say in a country like Sri Lanka, many boys who are 13, 14 years old will receive the pabbaja, novice ordination. To receive the upasampada, the full admission or high ordination, when it's supposed to be 20 years old from conception. And the samanera, the novice, takes 10 precepts, whereas the when receives the upasampada, then one becomes a bhikkhu. That means a full, or for a woman, bhikkhuni, fully ordained monk or nun. Then one has a much more elaborate code of precepts. I have to say, it's probably unlikely that Ratapala at this stage was aware of the distinction of these degrees of ordination. It would seem to me that the actual words that with which he's addressing the Buddha were put into his mouth by the compilers of the canon after this distinction and stages of ordination was fully established. Probably Ratapala would have simply asked the Buddha to ordain him as a Buddhist monk. Okay, so when Ratapala makes this request to the Buddha, then the Buddha says to him, or he asks him a question, have you received permission from your parents to go forth from the home life into homelessness? And Ratapala says, no, I haven't. Then the Buddha says, Tathagatas, the Tathagata is a designation for the Buddha. It means one who is thus come or thus gone, one who has attained to the ultimate truth. So Tathagatas do not give the going forth to anyone who does not have his parents' permission. Now this was a principle that was laid down by the Buddha very early in his ministry. Soon after his enlightenment, after the Buddha began teaching, he returned to his home state, the Sakyan Republic, and he began teaching the Sakyan people. And then he met for the first time in a number of years his former wife and his son from his marriage. This boy was Rahula. And Rahula now was 7 years old. And the mother said to Rahula, Rahula was very impressed by the sight of the Buddha when he first saw him and said, even the shadow of this ascetic is pleasing to me. So then his mother said to him, Rahula, go to your father and ask him for your inheritance. The mother probably had in mind that the Buddha should give him, the young prince Rahula should give him all of the treasures of wealth that were to fall to him if he had become the king. So Rahula came up to the Buddha and said, please, sir, give me my inheritance. Then the Buddha turned to Venerable Sariputta, who was standing next to him, and said, get the kid ordained. Why should I give him? Why should I give him treasures of material things which will just decay and vanish? Let me give him the supreme blessing, the supreme wealth of nirvana. And so he had Rahula ordained as a monk, as a novice monk, a samanera. And now when the Buddha's own father, King Suddhodana, heard about this, he was very upset. It had been very painful to him when his own son, Siddhartha, went forth to become an ascetic and then to become the Buddha. And now his grandson, Rahula, was ordained as a monk. And so Suddhodana came to the Buddha and made the request that he lay down a principle for the monastic order that monks will not give ordination, even the novice ordination, to anybody without, to any child without their parents' permission. And the Buddha agreed to this request. And then the Buddha laid it down that any monk who gives the novice ordination to a young person without the parent's permission is at fault for what is called a dukkha. That's a minor type of monastic offense. But strangely, within, at least within the Theravada system, when a child or a young person wants to be ordained, it's not compulsory to ask the question, do you have the parents' permission? So young people get ordained as novices. They can get ordained as novices without the parents' permission, but it is when giving the ceremony, the ordination of Upasampada, the higher ordination, that one has to request the candidate, do you have the parents' permission? And in that case, if they don't have the permission, then the higher ordination is denied, but they can still remain as a novice. It's just that the monk who gives the novice ordination without asking that question gets a minor offense, but the ordination is still valid. Okay, so now Ratapala has admitted that he doesn't have his parents' permission, and so the Buddha has said, in that case, I can't give you the ordination. So now Ratapala says, I shall see to it that I get my parents' permission to go forth from the home life into homelessness. And so now Ratapala goes to his parents, asks them for permission, explains to them his thought. Again, it's all expressed, probably for ease of transmission. It's put into these stock formulas. No doubt in actual life, Ratapala would have sat down with his parents and given them a long explanation, made very clear his reasons, his thoughts, his feelings. But if all of this explanation were to be preserved in the sutta, it would have been extremely difficult to transmit the text by the process of oral transmission. Okay, so when Ratapala makes the request to his parents for permission to go forth, then his parents say to him, we assume Ratapala might be a young man now. He would be at least 20 since he's asked for the full ordination. But they say to him, you are our only son, dear and beloved. And this would be very important in an Indian family, particularly a Brahmin family, where for a very strong reason, because when the parents die, in the Brahminic tradition, it's incumbent on the son to perform the funeral rites for them. And it is by the son performing the funeral rites that guarantees them a safe passage to the next world, to the afterlife. But here I think the parents are speaking not so much from these self-interested reflections, but more from their emotional feeling of attachment to their son. Okay, so they say, you have been raised in comfort, brought up in comfort. You know nothing of suffering, dear Ratapala. And this seems to be an important phrase, because Ratapala, though he's young, he has a very, very deep insight into the nature of the world. But his parents think that he's still an innocent child. He hasn't really experienced life yet. He doesn't know anything of suffering. So how could he think of leaving the worldly life for the homeless life? And then they refuse to give him permission. This is all very familiar to myself, since I went through the same thing when I wanted to become a monk. This is what my parents said to me: you're only 27 years old. You know nothing of life, nothing of suffering. And my other relative said, how can you, so young, you know nothing of suffering? Okay, so Ratapala asked three times for permission. Three times the parents refused. And then after this triple refusal, Ratapala lays down on the floor. He makes the declaration. This is very difficult, but it shows his very strong determination. He says, right here, I shall either die or receive the going forth. That is, he's made the determination, though it's not expressed that way in the sutta, that he will not accept any more food unless, and not move from this place until he receives the parents' permission. And I have to say, I find this a little bit difficult. And I think it also will jar somewhat with maybe a Western temperament. I would think that there would be ways, if we were to take a real life situation for a young person who wants to go forth, to deal with his parents' refusal in less, without giving them such a stern ultimatum. But what I would suppose has taken place is that Ratapala did actually make sustained efforts to convince his parents. Perhaps this attempts to convince them would have gone on several days, several weeks. But in order to heighten the traumatic impact of the sutta, the compilers of the canon had to compress it, or wanted to compress it, into this very short, striking scenario, where after just three refusals, Ratapala gives the parents this ultimatum: either you give me permission or I will die on hunger strike. I'll die of starvation. Now, I should also add that this process, this way of getting the permission to go forth, it's not very typical in Buddhist countries today. I don't know of any case of any monks who have received permission by pushing their parents up against the wall like this. I know of cases in Sri Lanka with other Westerners as well as Sri Lankan monks who tried to get their parents' permission. The parents were reluctant, and then they just continued to work at their job for some time, continually exposing their parents more and more to Buddha's teachings, explaining the reasons to them, until the parents relented and agreed for them to go forth. But I think the reason why this sutta was composed in the way it has been and has been included in the canon is to underscore this, I would call it a very, to express this, but to pinpoint this conflict of claims between the social order represented by the family over the individual on the one hand, and on the other hand, the right of the individual to embark on the course leading to deliverance, to liberation, despite the resistance and objections of the social order as represented by the family. In fact, we might even see the implications of this extending further beyond the social order itself, even to the whole biological order, the order of life, which insists that life must go on, life must continue through procreation, through the continuation from one generation to the next. In fact, basically, the same story as this comes in the Vinaya Pitaka as the background story leading up to the what is called the first expulsion offense. It's the first offense which leads to expulsion from the monastic order, which is indulgence in sexual intercourse. And in that case, we have a story of a young man who goes forth, just like as Ratapala does. He returns to visit his family, and the family appeals to him, please stay at home and lead a household life. He refuses. Then the parents say to him, okay, if you want to remain a monk, fine. But at least you left your wife behind, at least beget a child through her, so we will have an heir, somebody to pass the family wealth to. And so then this person, Sudina is his name, reflects and thinks, now there are no monastic rules laid down yet. So he thinks there are no rules prohibiting this. I'll get my wife pregnant, she'll have a child, and I can go off and meditate happily ever after. And so he does this, and then when the report comes to the Buddha, then the Buddha lays down that very strict rule. No sexual relations for monastics. Okay, so now we have Ratapala is stretched out on the floor here, saying, holding up the sign, permission or or bust. Parental permission or bust. And so the parents appeal to him, and then they lay down the line saying, you get up, eat, drink, and amuse yourself. You can be happy enjoying sensual pleasures and making merit. That is, they try to convince him that if you remain as a householder, you can still lead a virtuous life. You can do meritorious deeds by doing acts of charity, offering alms to the monks, to the ascetics. You could engage in welfare projects for the community. And so you can do meritorious deeds which will lead to a happy rebirth. But we don't want you to leave the household life. They say, even if you were to die, we would lose you unwillingly. So now while you're alive, how can we let you go forth? And so three times this exchange goes on, three times Ratapala remains there insisting, I want to get your permission. Then the parents go to the friends of Ratapala, and they ask the friends, come, convince your friend Ratapala, convince him to get up and to give up this foolish idea of going forth. the friends try on behalf of the parents, but they don't succeed. Ratapala is still persisting in his determination. And so finally, the friends, Ratapala's friends, go to the parents and say to them, "We can't convince him." It's apparent, probably now several days have gone by, and Ratapala has not taken any food, maybe not taken any water. Maybe he's getting weak, sickly. And so they realize that he is intent on fulfilling, remaining true to his resolution, that he won't abandon it, but will either die there or get permission. And so the friends now set out to convince Ratapala's parents to relent and give him permission. So they say that if you give him your permission, if you don't give him permission, it's obvious that he's going to die. But if you give him your permission, then he will live and he'll come back from time to time and you will be able to see him. And then if he goes forth, maybe he won't be happy with the monastic life. Once he sees how different it is from the life of comfort and luxury to which he's accustomed, he might just think that it's not for me. And then he'll return to the family life. So they say, give him permission to go forth. And so the parents then agree to allow Ratapala to go forth. But they lay down a condition. After he is ordained, then he must come to visit his parents from time to time. Okay, so the friends now report this back to Ratapala, and Ratapala is very happy, and he gets up. He probably resumes taking normal food till he regains his strength. And then he goes to the Buddha and tells him that he has received his parents' permission to go forth. And then the Buddha gives him the ordination, both the novice ordination and the full ordination. And then sometime later, I think it's a half month after Ratapala is ordained, the Buddha leaves this Brahmin village, Tulakotita, and goes back to Savatthi, his main base. And then the text, now we're in paragraph 14, says, before long, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the Venerable Ratapala, by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge, here and now entered upon and abided in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. And then, in other words, he becomes an arhat. And though the text says, before long, na chiraseva, which means in no long time, the commentary glosses this by saying 12 years. There are some who can achieve arhatship very quickly, sometimes even just by listening to the Buddha give a discourse. Some who have to train for a short period. Some who have to train for a more extended period. And Ratapala belongs in that third category. And so after Ratapala, and even though the commentary pulls this figure seemingly out of nowhere, we'll see from the ensuing text that it seems to have a sound reason for making this statement. Okay, now after Ratapala attains arhatship, then he comes to the Buddha and tells him that he wants to visit his parents. And he asks for permission to do so. And now, before the Buddha gives his permission, he uses his own very powerful mind, to examine Ratapala's mind. Because the Buddha would have been apprehensive that if Ratapala had some weak spot or defect in his character, that his parents could have taken advantage of this and using suitable ploys and strategies, they could have put suitable tactics, they could have convinced him to give up the training or enticed him to come back to the worldly life, and then all of his hard years of practice would have been thrown away. But when the Buddha looked into the mind of Ratapala, he realized, he could see that Ratapala had completely eradicated all of the defilements and was incapable of returning to the worldly life. And so the Buddha then gave him permission and said, "You can go." Okay, now we come to the next scene in this unfolding drama. Ratapala arrives back in his hometown and excuse me, my voice is and he settles in a garden which the king had established for the use of wandering ascetics. And then the next morning, Ratapala sets out with his alms bowl, going for alms round in the town. And he goes from house to house, and eventually he arrives at his father's house, the family house. And on this occasion, the father is sitting, presumably says in the hall of the central door, but probably this is a room which looks out upon the street. And he sees Ratapala coming in the distance. And the thought comes into his mind when he sees somebody in the distinctive robe and garb of a Buddhist ascetic approaching, then the father becomes angry and thinks that my own son was taken away from me by these, he uses a derogatory term, by these bald, pated recluses. But I have to say, this seems to me, again, that this is composition by the compilers of the canon to create a dramatic incident. Since I just put myself in the position of a father whose son has been taken away to go forth as a Buddhist monk. He hasn't seen him for many years. Now he sees a figure coming in the distance with the distinctive marks of a Buddhist monk. He's not going to become angry at this figure thinking, they stole my son. But wouldn't he be thinking, could that be my son coming back? Wouldn't that be the more probable thought? Excuse me? Maybe, I don't know. So anyway, when Ratapala came to the father's house, then the text says rather mildly that he received neither alms nor a polite refusal. Instead, he received only abuse. So the father would have spoken angrily and said, and you see, this is what seems to indicate that a long time must have gone by, because the father didn't recognize him. If it was just even 1 year, 2 year, 2 years, the father should have realized that this is his own son. But if it was 12 years, then it still seems to me that the father would have recognized the son even after 12 years. I've seen friends that I haven't seen after 20 years, 22 years, and recognize them well enough.
Yeah, but it doesn't work the other way around.
Yeah.
My own experience is as monastic, we kind of freeze the time with our friends in the mundane world.
Yeah.
and then we go into the homeless plight.
Yeah.
We remember them as such.
Yeah.
But their life continues in the name. When they see us, they don't recognize that away.
Mm.
That's my experience. Yeah. It's easier for us to remember our friend or recognize our friend, even after 12 years, 20 years.
Yeah.
But it's not as easy for them to recognize.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Especially if he was 20 years and between 20, 32, 33. It would have changed quite a bit. Okay, so the father abuses him. And now just then, a slave woman in the household was about to throw away some stale porridge. And Ratapala saw this and said, if you're going to throw that stuff away, then you might as well put it into my alms bowl. And then when she is doing so, then she recognizes the distinctive characteristic features of Ratapala from, she doesn't recognize the face or the body, but somehow she recognizes certain characteristic features of the hands, feet, and voice. Again, whether this is real actual fact or a dramatic episode, I don't know. But when the servant woman recognizes Ratapala, she's astonished. She goes to the mother and says, know that your son Ratapala has come back. And the mother says, if this is true, you're free. You're no longer a slave. Then Ratapala's mother goes to the father and says, please know that they're saying that Ratapala has come back. And the father must, when he hears this, he must have realized that this ascetic who he just abused, that this is his own son. And meanwhile, Ratapala, after receiving the porridge, has gone to a certain shelter that was set up in the town, the shelter for the use of wandering ascetics. And he's taking his food. And then the father comes up to him and tries to appeal to him to come to the house. And the father is now ashamed and embarrassed that he had refused him food. And he now sees his son eating this leftover porridge. And says, come to your own house. But Ratapala says, now I have no house. I am a homeless one. And when I went to your house, I didn't receive alms there. I didn't even get a polite refusal. Polite refusal is when one says, we're sorry, sir, we don't have any food prepared now. If you like alms, please come back tomorrow. We will be certain to have something ready for you. But instead, all you did was abuse me. Then the father tries to convince him to come back to the house and have a meal. But Ratapala says, I finished my meal for today. But the father now invites him to come for the next day's meal. And Ratapala consents in silence. But the father has a plot in his mind. And so the next passage explains this plot. The father goes back to the house. He has all of the gold coins and bullion. This is all of the family wealth. He has collects it all into a pile, covers it over with mats so it doesn't appear. And then he goes to Ratapala's former wives and ask them to adorn themselves in the ways that Ratapala used to find made them most dear and lovable before his going forth. Does anything seem a little peculiar in that passage?
She thought that he wasn't married.
Yeah.
Now, I have a question.
Yeah, yeah.
In the Indian custom,
yeah,
they usually arrange marriage at a young age.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, if there was a, such a case when someone of that of the son, a son goes forth.
Yeah.
Is the family obligated to still take the female into the family?
It would seem to me that would not be the case.
No. So they are like.
Of course, I haven't studied the mores, the customs of ancient India from that perspective. But just intuitively, it would seem that if a childhood marriage is arranged between a boy and a girl, or in this case, several girls, and then the son goes forth before the marriage is consummated, it would seem that the parents of the son would not be under any obligation to take those girls into their household after they grow up.
My understanding is like even in China, old
China,
they would have to.
They would have to.
Yeah, because the girls are considered kind of like, you know, women were considered property.
Yeah.
And if they were already given to someone, they would, the girls' parents would have received some kind of gift. Things like that. And they wouldn't give it back. I mean, so in the end, the male family would still have to take care of that girl. Otherwise, she would have to starve or go,
This I don't know. But it's rather, I have to say, it's rather strange that the wives are introduced here. One would think, especially when it says that, adorn yourself with ornaments in the way Ratapala found you most dear and lovable. So Ratapala would have known these girls, or his wives, from before, the time before his renunciation. And if he was 20 years old at that time, then he would have certainly have been old enough to have consummated the marriage, assuming that they were roughly of the same age or maybe a few years younger. And one would think in that period, if the parents wanted to prevent Ratapala from going forth, instead of calling on the friends to convince him, they first would have called on the wives, go to your husband and try to persuade him to remain.
It is exactly the same in the Agama. I was trying to find out
whether there's any difference.
Any other,
The text is pretty much word for word. Okay, so the next day Ratapala comes for his meal, goes to the father's house. Then when he arrives, the father unveils the pile, before serving the meal, he unveils the pile of gold coins and bullion and says, this is the legacy coming from your mother, this is your paternal fortune, this is what comes from the other ancestors. Come, give up your monastic robes. As my mother always used to say to me, grow your hair. So now even if she used to say, why don't you grow your hair? Now even if I wanted to, I couldn't do it. Even to get that 1 inch for the doctor to test, I was having trouble. Getting 1 inch of hair. Come, enjoy the wealth and do acts of merit. And now Ratapala speaks to the father. These sound like really stern words. It might be very somewhat difficult for a Westerner to empathize with a son speaking to a father in this way. Does that seem to be the case? Such tough words. If you would follow my advice, then take this pile of gold coins and bullion, put it on carts, carry it to the river Ganges and dump it in the middle of the stream. Because on account of this, there will arise for you sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I think a modern young man, if he were in a situation like that, he would try to appeal to his parents and say, please understand that I have reasons for taking the living as a monk. These are my reasons. I'm not interested in wealth, the enjoyments that wealth can provide. But it seems that, again, I have to say, this sutta seems to be like a dramatic way of highlighting this. On the one hand, from one aspect, this clash or conflict between the demands and expectations of the household life, and on the other, the individual's urge, move, yearning for spiritual freedom. And so to bring out that conflict, that contrast within its starkest form, various sort of dramatic devices have to be used. Okay, then the former wives of Ratapala come up and they clasp his feet and say to him, what are they like, those nymphs for whose sake you are leading the holy life? Now what this means, you see, like there was an idea that one gives up the worldly life and leads an ascetic life with the hope that one will be reborn in one or another of the heavenly worlds, the heavenly worlds that are occupied by these beautiful, what do you call them, celestial maidens. We call them acharas or apsaras. And so, in ancient India, many men who were not very successful with the with the ladies in the human world would then go forth and lead an ascetic life, fasting, sleeping on beds of thorns, exposing their bodies to the heat of the sun, the cold of the winter, not thinking maybe tomorrow I'll attain nirvana, maybe next week I'll attain nirvana. No. Thinking, maybe in my next life I'll be reborn in that heavenly world. Oh, I've heard the maidens, the celestial maidens in that world, some have black hair with twinkly eyes. Some have blonde hair with fluttering eyes. Beautiful, bewitching smiles. I heard such and such a guru praise the beauties of that world. Maybe I will get to be reborn there. And so Ratapala says, I'm not leading the religious life for the sake of nymphs, sisters. And then when he calls them sisters, then they become... they cry out, they become agitated, and they faint. Okay, so now Ratapala, though he's trying to remain patient, but he says to his father, if you want to offer the meal, then offer it, but don't make trouble for me. So the father finally seemingly gives up on his tactics and offers the meal. And according to the commentary, I don't know if this is in the Chinese version, but according to the commentary, the father had also posted two sentries outside the house with instructions that when Ratapala leaves, you grab him, if he doesn't agree to our appeals to return to the household life, when he leaves, you grab him by both arms and forcefully you strip the yellow robes off him and clothe him forcefully in householder garments. Is that in the Chinese book? About the two sentries, two strong men put out there.
His father told him once.
Yeah, to remove the robes and put on the white clothes. No, it's not there. Okay, it's purely commentarial. Then. Yeah, yeah. Okay, then Ratapala, after he eats his meal, then he stands up and he utters some verses. Again, these are ideas which are constant themes in early Buddhism about the deceptive nature of the bodily, the beauty of the body. When you look inside the body beneath the skin, it's just a mass of foul impurities built up out of sores. There's nothing stable here. It might be decorated with jewelry, earrings, makeup, but it's really just a skeleton wrapped in skin. Maybe the ideas are rather strong for present-day temperaments. But then Ratapala comes to the last verse. He says, the deer hunter set out the snare. The snare was the gold and then the beautiful former wives. But the deer did not spring the trap. We ate the bait. That's the meal that was offered, and now depart, leaving the hunters to lament. Okay, I'll try to finish the sutta. I see there's quite a bit to do, but there's a fair number of repetitive passages. Okay, now so Ratapala gets up and utters these stanzas. And according to the commentary, again, this is not so believable, Ratapala rises up into the air through supernormal powers and departs through the air. That is, to avoid the strong men who are waiting outside the door to grab him and strip off his robes. Then he goes back to the garden set up by the king and spends his day meditating at the foot of a tree. And now, here again, an incident that seems a little peculiar. The king addresses his gameskeeper to go to the garden and tidy up the park. And when the gamekeeper goes to the garden, he sees Ratapala sitting at the foot of the tree, and then he returns to the king and tells the king that the clansman Ratapala is there, the one of whom you have always spoken highly. Now the gamekeeper recognizes Ratapala. Of course, it's possible by this time the report has already gone through the town that Ratapala has returned. Possible. But maybe this is a somewhat fictional incident put in order to sustain the continuity of the drama. And so when the king hears this, apparently, according to the commentary, after Ratapala had left the town and become an ascetic, the king was always praising him, how could this son of the richest family, the leading family, abandon so much wealth to lead a renunciate life that took a great deal of courage, determination, fixity of purpose. And so the king was always eager to see, would have been very eager to see Ratapala. So as soon as he hears that Ratapala has returned, at once he stops what he's doing and goes out in the state carriage to meet him. Okay, he meets Ratapala, and now he wants to open a discussion with Ratapala to ask him why he has gone forth into the homeless life. And this will provide an opportunity for Ratapala to introduce some of the fundamental ideas behind the Buddha's teaching, the ideas which provide, you might call, the backdrop and motivation for this very traumatic step of renouncing the worldly life, the household life, for the homeless life. So now the king is speaking from his own experience, and he says that there are four types of loss or decay that induce people to go forth into homelessness. These four are loss through aging, through old age, loss through sickness, loss of wealth, and loss of relatives. Okay, loss through aging. Somebody has lived a full life. He's maybe been married, had children, enjoyed the full variety of sensual pleasures, performed his service in the community, and now he has reached advanced years, and he decides that there's no point for me to continue in the household life. I may as well do deeds of great merit by going forth, or at least make some effort in my old age to achieve liberation. And so then he shaves off the hair and beard and goes into the homeless life. This is actually a common practice in Buddhist countries, at least in Sri Lanka, that there are very pious men who, after they complete their family life, while living the family life, they're very fond of going to the temples, associating with monks. And after their children are grown up, completed their education, the children are married and able to take care of themselves. Sometimes after the wife dies, or even they're able to arrange for the children, one of the children, to take care of the wife, then they decide to become ordained as monks. And then they get ordained in old age. And when one has lived as a monk for a while, one develops a kind of faculty, like when I visit a temple or hermitage, when you see somebody who we call Buddha Pabajita, one who's gone forth in old age, almost intuitively the sense comes we could distinguish who is like a real Mahatera, who has been a monk for many, many years, just from something in the manner gives the person away, the way the person conducts himself. And who has been gone forth in old age? It's sort of like a sixth sense that one acquires. Okay, but here Ratapala went forth when he was a black-haired young man, endowed with the blessing of youth. The other case, the next case, is one who has become sickly, weak, gravely ill, and he can't earn any more wealth, can't enjoy worldly pleasures. And so he thinks, I'll go forth as an ascetic. So I have to say, it seems difficult for me to understand how somebody who is sick can go forth in his ascetic, since the ascetic life makes such stern demands on the physical body. But Ratapala has gone forth in the prime of life when he was in excellent health. Okay, the next is when somebody loses all of his wealth and he tries, but he can't acquire any more wealth. So he thinks, if I'm going to live in poverty, at least let me do so in grand style, with receiving the respect and veneration of people. And so they go forth as ascetics. And so now, instead of having to beg rather abjectly for food from people, give me the supports of life, now they can just go with their ascetic robes and alms bowl, and people think, a sadhu, a holy man, let us give offerings to him. And then they can enjoy a quite comfortable life. But Ratapala has gone forth with full possession of wealth. And in the fourth case, somebody loses all of his relatives, friends, companions, and so he has nobody to associate with, And so he thinks, if I'm going to live alone, I might as well do so as an ascetic. Bharatapala was a very popular young man with many friends and companions. Okay, so the king is puzzled and he wants to draw out from Bharatapala the reason. Why is it that you have gone forth as a young man in the prime of health from a wealthy, well-established family and with many, many friends and relatives? And now Bharatapala is going to explain his reasons for going forth. And this will show us what was the perception of suffering that Bharatapala had gained from listening to that first discourse of the Buddha that he heard. What was it that impressed him so deeply and induced him to take that momentous step of leaving behind his prestigious family, leaving behind all of the wealth, his wives, his friends? What was it that he had seen and understood to motivate him to go forth into homelessness? And so Bharatapala answers with what he calls four summaries of the Dhamma that have been taught by the Blessed One who knows and sees. And when I knew, saw, and heard these four summaries, then I went forth into homelessness. But the Bharatapala says that he's heard these four summaries of the doctrine taught by the Buddha. But in fact, these four summaries in just this form don't come any place in the Pali Nikayas. The ideas are there, but we don't have this set of four items grouped together. So perhaps this was a teaching which somehow was not preserved by the elders, or perhaps it's just that Bharatapala on his own is combining ideas that have come from different sources in order to make this group of four items. Okay, the first theme is that, as it's set out in the sutta, life in any world is unstable. It is swept away. I've put the Pali, and I've translated somewhat more literally. The second is that life in any world has no shelter and no protector. Third is life in any world has nothing of its own. One has to leave all and pass on. That is the third summary. The fourth, life in any world is incomplete, insatiate, the slave of craving. That is the fourth summary. Okay, now the king asked Bharatapala to expound or to elaborate on these four summaries. And Bharatapala will do so. And he does so always in very concrete, immediately visible ways, so the king could understand this from his own experience. In fact, all four of the arguments or presentations that Bharatapala gives to the king relate directly to the king's own experience. He doesn't draw upon very abstract ideas. Okay, first to explain that life in any world is unstable, it is swept away. Hear this word. First, Loco, literally, it's the world, but it means life in the world. It's a dukkha. The key word here is dukkha, is what is stable or lasting. Adukkha is the negation of that. Then upaniyati means that it's moving on, or even say that it's approaching its end. Okay, so now Ratapala asks the king a question. He says, when you were 20, 25 years old, a young man, you were skilled in so many different aspects of kingship. You were able to ride elephants, horses. You were able to shoot arrows. You were able to fight with swords. You had a strong body, sturdy, capable in battle. Isn't that the case? And the king says, yes. And now he asks, are you now so strong? Now are you sturdy and skilled in so many different arts? And the king now, he's 80 years old. He says, now I am old, aged, burdened with years. Come to the last stage. I've turned 80. When I lift my foot, I want to put it in front of me. Sometimes on its own, it goes to the side. And so, Ratapala says, it was on account of this that the Blessed One has said, life in any world is unstable, it is swept away. And when I knew and saw this for myself, then I went forth into homelessness. And here, this first point, the sutta doesn't make any attempt to correlate these four points with any other doctrinal framework. But it seems to me that this first point is illustrating the law of impermanence, the characteristic of anicca or impermanence. And it's doing so in the sense of indicating or implying, even though the king now, he's 80 years old, so now he's obviously old. But the point is that with this verb upaniyati, we're moving on or approaching. It means even when Ratapala was a young man, 20 years old, listening to this discourse of the Buddha, he wasn't thinking, now I'm 20, and somehow a snap of the fingers later, and then I'm 80 years old. But he realized that all the time, this is the nature of life. We are constantly being swept on from the moment of birth. We're moving constantly to old age and death. So every day we look in the mirror, same person there, right? Everything identical. But if you take the frames 20 years apart, big difference. So we look at the see a person for the first time, he's 80 years old, we assume he's always been like that. It's just his tough luck. He got born like that, and won't happen to me. But in fact, we're always moving in that direction. Okay, so this is the process of impermanence, which is unfolding from moment to moment. Okay, the next theme or topic of Dhamma. Okay, when Ratapala explains this, then the king is pleased and says, it's wonderful, it's marvelous how well this has been expressed by the Blessed One who knows and sees. And he admits, it is indeed so. Life in any world is unstable, swept away. Okay, now the king is giving a sort of counter-argument. He says, now there exist in this court elephant troops, cavalry, chariot troops, infantry. They are able to vanquish any threats to us. And yet you say life in any world has no shelter and no protector. How should we understand the meaning of this? Now, Ratapala again asks, with reference to the king, do you have any chronic ailment? And the king says, I have a chronic wind ailment. And sometimes, probably he's coughing, maybe it's kind of asthma that he has. And so he's coughing, breathing very heavily. And so all of his friends and relatives are standing around him thinking the king is going to die, the king is going to die. And now Ratapala says, can you request your friends and relatives? Come, friends, come, my relatives. Please take this illness away from me. You love me so much, why don't you take it upon your own shoulders and share it so that I might be relieved of my pain? Or is it the case that you have to experience this pain yourself? And the king says, I cannot ask my friends and relatives to take the pain upon themselves, but I have to experience it myself. Okay, so this teaching, this principle of the Dhamma, this is what substantiates the claim that life in any world has no shelter and no protector. And this, to my mind, this seems to be a kind of pointer to the characteristic of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness or suffering. That it's just, it's a fact of life that we each have to bear our own pain and suffering, that nobody can, by an act of magic, can take our pain and suffering upon themselves. Even though other people can help us, give us relief, console us, doctors can give us medicine, but in the final analysis, we all have to grow old ourselves. Nobody can, with a wave of a magic wand, make us young again when we're sick. Even though medical science can do wonders, but there are many illnesses that medical science cannot alleviate, and those we have to bear. And in the end, we have to die alone. Okay, then the next principle of teaching or summary is paragraph 40 now. The king says, in this court there is abundant gold and bullion stored in vaults and depositories. So you say life has nothing of its own. We have to leave and pass on. How should we understand this? So Ratapala says, now you are enjoying yourself endowed with the five cords of sensual pleasure. But will you be able to determine, let me enjoy these same five objects of sense pleasures in the future, in my next life? Or will you just go on to your next life in accordance with your karma, and then you have to leave all of your wealth behind and others will take possession of it? And then the king has to admit that I have to go on alone and others will take possession of my property, my wealth. Not only the wealth, this is an idea that we have, sabban bahaya gamaniyang. One has to abandon everything when one passes on to the next life. And we often analyze this in terms of the three things that one has to give up and leave behind. First, one has to leave behind one's wealth, one's possessions. Then one has to leave behind all one's friends and relatives. And then third, one has to leave behind even this physical body. So everything has to be given up. And in my mind, this seems to be a pointer to the characteristic of non-self, in the sense of one doesn't have any kind of complete possession or mastery over things. But everything, one says, it's mine, the bank account is in my name, I write the checks. But in fact, we give it up, and everybody else, others take possession of it, and we take nothing with us when we go. Okay, then the fourth characteristic or fourth theme of teaching is that this world is incomplete or lacking, that it's insatiable, never satisfied, but a slave of craving. And now Ratapala uses arguments which will be immediately comprehensible to a king. Okay, now we could use this argument for any with any country. This is the nature of empires. Okay, now the king has, he's ruling over this Kuru kingdom, which is one of the major kingdoms of northern India. But suppose a man came from the east and said that there is a large country, powerful and rich to the east. It has a lot of troops, a lot of gold and bullion. It has women for you to take as wives. And you're able to conquer it. Go ahead and conquer it. What would you do? Would you just say, as a king, I'm satisfied with what I have. I don't need any more territory. No. If the king could conquer it, he'll go ahead and conquer it. And similarly, the west, north, south, across the sea, if there's a country, would you conquer it? Again, he's just like a puppet controlled by his craving. I'll conquer it. So this indicates the nature of craving. As long as we work on the premise that craving is the key to happiness, we'll just go on being driven by that craving to pursue this enjoyment, this pleasure, this object, with never an end in sight. And so when Ratapala saw that it's the very nature of craving, always to be dissatisfied, always to want more, then he knew that the only release was through ending craving by entering on the homeless life. And so when he saw that, then he went forth into homelessness. Okay, that is the statement of Ratapala. And then he ends the sutta with some verses. Actually, these verses are also found in the Theragatha, the collection of verses of the elders. They're actually very beautiful, very moving verses on the inevitability of death and the implications that we can draw out from reflections on death. But I won't expound them. But I really do suggest that you read them and reflect on them. Okay, if there's any questions, comments. Yeah, please. That's an interesting question. I found that question, it's raised in the commentary to the sutta. And the commentary raises the question, isn't it inappropriate for an ascetic, a Buddhist monk, to be requesting food? And in fact, one doesn't do that as a monk when one goes on alms round. But then the commentary answers, Generally, when a monk goes on alms round, he just goes silently from door to door. This is the way it's done. In Thailand, people are expecting monks to go on alms round, so they already have set up little stalls along the road with their food on the stalls, and then when the monks come, they just put the bags into the bowl, or rice into the bowl. But in Sri Lanka, it's not customary for monks to go on alms round. So people, generally, they don't have food ready for monks. So when one goes on alms round, one just stands silently in front of the house, waiting for people to notice you. And in Sri Lanka, except in the middle class, upper middle class homes, people live partly outdoors, partly indoors. So the doors to the house are usually open, windows are open. And when they see a monk standing there, then they get very excited. And sometimes they'll have some food which they're preparing for a meal, not intended for the monk. But I do know some people who prepare some food every day early in the morning, thinking maybe a monk will come by today. And so when they see a monk, then they get very excited, and then they'll come and they'll put the food in the monk's bowl. But the monk is not supposed to ask for anything. But the commentary explains in this case, the servant woman was going to throw the food away. So because she had that intention, and the intention was clear to Ratthapala, it was as if it was just already discarded food. So in this case, there was no fault in his asking for the food. Yeah.
In Satipatthana Sutta, I understood that the full town was a town of people who could practice really well.
Yeah. Actually, it was the town, the Kuru country was actually a whole province, not a town. But within the Kuru country, there was a town called Kamasa Dhamma. That's where the Buddha taught the Satipatthana Sutta, as well as the other deep suttas, like the Great Discourse on Causation. And it said that the people in that town, Kamasa Dhamma, were already very dedicated to the practice of yeah, probably the Kuru country would correspond roughly to Uttar Pradesh today. Where do you find them? It's in the first book of the Anguttara Nikaya, the Book of Ones, where the Buddha mentions the outstanding disciples in each of these categories, like in the category of wisdom amongst the monks, Venerable Sariputta, psychic powers, Moggallana, amongst those who have good memories, Venerable Ananda.
You said about the context of the son, I will die, or unless he will be committed. In my culture, it's not unusual. I mean, it seems to me it's very, it's not unusual. To have your will work, even mothers do that, and you know, even nowadays some people go hunger strike. But in the past, that was one way of actually doing it. And also, another thing to me here is very natural. The marriage also. Usually, people marry like if you are in good family. 12 years old, 14 years old, you already married.
Yeah.
So if by the time you're 20, it's just so natural that you
Actually, that is so.
Right.
Yeah.
Very natural. So it's not like a, to me, a lot of things are not dramatic.
Yeah.
What
dramatic devices.
Devices.
Yeah.
Very
nice. Yeah. So it's a little puzzling why, if Ratnapala was married already before his going forth, why the parents didn't appeal to the wives to try to convince him to give up his thought of renunciation. Yeah. Maybe so.
And also even when he came back, and then he was very stern about his talking to his father.
Yeah.
That also to me is not unusual because in Korea, once your son became a monk,
yeah,
they don't have a like a family relationship anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So even now, when the son as a monk comes back and the mother sees the son, not as a son.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
So here he said.
The mother treats the son. You said.
The mother treats the son as a monk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you have something to say?
No, I agree with that.
Mm.
I know people who became mothers and the next day they're calling their parents householders.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm.
Because they're afraid of being sucked into it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
And so I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm not making a comment on that. I'm just saying that it does make sense.
Mm.
It's possible.
Mm.
Especially in a culture
where
the man is so highly regarded and the only son is so important for the procreation of the family lineage.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to stand up firmly on the ground, ground, one must say certain things or do certain actions to make it seem like one is unwavering.
Maybe I'll try when I visit my father. Any questions, comments? Yeah.
How is Ananda able to record this? And also, who I'm from is why did he record this? I guess we could figure what the follow-up went back and maybe.
Yeah.
This wasn't the Buddha giving the teachings, so I wouldn't like, okay, come on. And then during the council, he's going over all the teachings. I'm not sure why this one would come up, especially since it doesn't, especially since it's so different from, it doesn't recognize to a discourse of the Buddha.
Though it says that Ananda was the main person reciting what he had memorized, but it does not imply that he is the only person saying that. There are more, other than Ananda, even in the Vinaya, it's not just Venerable
Bhupali.
Yeah, he's not the only one. I mean, others who remember certain things that Buddha has said, they can bring it up. That's the way I understand.
Yeah, the thing is, Ananda did not only memorize suttas that came from the Buddha, but others would have reported to Ananda either suttas that they had expounded or they had heard from others. But again, that is assuming, taking what I would call a very innocent view of the compilation of the suttas, whereas I would be inclined to see some amount of composition taking place and purposes at work here. And particularly, my thought is that the purpose of the main purpose, that each Nikaya has its main purpose. The main purpose of the Digha Nikaya is to serve to propagate the Buddha's teachings amongst people in the contemporary society, and to convince non-Buddhists of the virtues of the Buddha and his teaching. So we have in the Digha Nikaya many long popular style teachings, obviously intended for a popular audience, as well as teachings which show the superiority of the Buddha and the Buddhist monks to the Brahmins. The Buddha is engaging in debates with the Brahmins. The Buddha is showing him, appears superior to the gods worshipped by the people in the contemporary society. The main purpose of the Majjhima Nikaya, in my view, is to serve as a kind of compendium of the doctrine and the training for monastics. It's not exclusive, but there's a special emphasis upon the training of monks. And so this sutta, as I indicated during my explanation, sort of brings into a very concise and dramatic form this justification or rationale behind the decision to renounce the world and enter upon the homeless life. And it does this by dramatically expressing this conflict between the demands of family, society, even the biological order, and the urge, yearning, longing of the person for spiritual liberation, and a kind of justification of the right of that individual to go forth into homelessness despite all of the pressure put on him or her by the society, community, and family to remain within the world and to contribute in wholesome ways the prolongation of mundane life.
Yeah, okay. Something like that, I could definitely see one monk saying, oh my gosh, my parents are giving me such a stress. One monk saying, let me tell you the story about the poverty.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And then that getting into the jam.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But the fact that he is pronounced by the Buddha the foremost of those who have gone forth into homelessness. So there's probably a kernel of a story that's true behind it already. But the way the story came to be, one could see that the compilers of the canon elaborating some kind of building upon this original kernel of the story, then elaborating it. You know, you have to have conversations which would never have been learned by any person, thoughts that have come into the mind of people that are never recorded by any person. You have to include them in order to give continuity to the story. Any further questions, comments? Yeah.
And it occurred to me too that 1, 4, and 3 seem to be Anicca, Dukkha, and Anatta. We could on the board that number, the world is unstable.
Yeah.
It's permanent.
Yeah.
The world is lacking.
Yeah.
Dukkha.
Yeah.
The world is on the
I see, I see, I see. Yeah. Actually, one could put four. No, one could put four on the mark of suffering too.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that would be the mark of suffering.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. That's what I said. Yeah. Because it's illustrated by the case that nobody can take the pain and misery of another. Each has to bear that suffering himself. Herself. Okay, it's rather later than usual, so we'll have to stop now. Okay, next week we take sutta number, these are the suttas on the reason. Now we sort of enter into a new field. This is the training of the mind. And then we take the purpose of the holy life, two suttas. One is number 63, and the other is sutta number 29, is that, or 30?
29.
29. Perhaps I'll be able to deal with two suttas in one class next week. Okay, thank you for your attention, and now we share the merits. Do you have that page? Okay. Akasata jabumata devanaga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata jabumata devanaga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata jabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyam Tang Anamodipa Chirang Rakantu Mang Parang Etavata Cham Hehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Deva Anamodantu Sabha Sampati